You're listening to live courtroom coverage of the trial of Lori Vallow Daybell from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. Now, back to the courtroom.
And he lets everyone know he did. And he confronts Tammy, lets her know. Confronts Chad, lets him know. And he certainly lets the defendant know that he knows. And now, the jig is up. We see in these text messages that were recovered from the iCloud accounts, whether they're under the Bubby contacts or under the Melanie 2 contact, this relationship between Lori and Chad. If you want to read the story, it kind of mimics them meeting in November, hooking up in hotels, and discussing their love for each other. When we are talking about a motive and a person who wants money and who has not worked for 13 years, who has had her husband pay for her homes, her phones, her cars, allowing her to go to the temple and work out and go to lunch and restaurants. This is a big change in life if she loses all of this. But if she gets $1 million, it's not so big of a difference, along with that Social Security she'll be getting. And then obviously we know that once Charles was out of the way, Lori and Chad were able to get married. But what about those religious beliefs? Everyone that Lori knew, who she expressed them to, told you that they were not in line with the Church of Latter-day Saints. Everyone told you that she said things like she didn't need to repent, she didn't need forgiveness, she could do whatever she wanted now, that she was in a celestial state, translated, that she is spiritually and physically changing, that she's above the priesthood, that she knew who was dark and evil. You saw those text messages, both about Charles and heard from people, as well as about Brandon and Zach and Adam. People who were helping Charles were also dark or Z's. And ultimately, what did we learn? That she associated herself with Nephi, a prophet, a holy man, who was justified and asked by God to kill Laban because he was an evil, wicked king who had the tablets that God wanted him to go get. Lori was just like that. She was justified in her killing. We heard from her brother, Adam, that their relationship had ended when she told him some things about her beliefs that he disagreed with. That she was turning into that celestial state, that she didn't need to eat, that she had more authority than the priesthood.
Yes.
You yourself personally, were you aware of Lori having outside? Having any beliefs that were outside of what is accepted by the LDS religion?
Yes.
Can you tell us what you were aware of that you knew to be outside the LDS religion?
Lori told me that she was in the process of translating from a mortal human being to an immortal human being, a celestial state.
That's something that the LDS religion supports?
I haven't heard of it in that it's happened here on Earth yet.
Serena Sharp told us about, again, the not repenting and glory changing physically and spiritually.
Members of the LDS Church?
Yes.
During
this time, did Lori ever tell you things about her beliefs that seemed to go against what you understood or what you were taught through the LDS Church?
Yes.
Did Lori ever tell you that she did not need to repent?
Yes, she did.
During this weekend, did Lori talk to you about her husband, Charles Vallow, being possessed?
Yes, she did.
What do you recall about her talking about her husband being possessed?
I recall that she spoke about her husband being possessed by an evil spirit, and she named the evil spirit.
Do you recall what the name was?
Yes.
What was it?
It was Ned.
N-E-D? Ned?
N-E-D.
Now, Serena Sharp was someone who met Lori in November, texted or talked with her for a while, and then was invited to that girls' weekend. One of the jury instructions you're looking at, and we'll talk about more, though, is the credibility of a witness. Serena Sharp has no dog in this fight. She knew Lori for a little while. She was invited to, I'll call it, the inner circle. The defendant told her some things that went against her religious beliefs, and she said pretty much after that the defendant stopped talking to her. Now, how do we know she's being truthful? Well, we see Ned in lots of text messages. This just helps tell us that this is something Lori was telling lots of people, that her husband is possessed by this evil spirit, Ned. And we learn later that, like Nephi, she can get rid of him.
Do you recall Lori Vallow telling you that her husband, Charles, was no longer Charles? That he was now this possessed person?
Yes.
When Lori was talking to you about Ned, was she explaining that this evil spirit was now in the body of her husband?
I don't know if she used those exact terms, but that was the impression I got, yes.
So the word she used expressed to you that idea that this evil spirit, Ned, was now in her husband's body.
Yes.
The other thing that Serena Sharp told us was Lori using that term zombie. You remember how upset the defendant got by her saying that. But again, why would Serena make up any of this? She has no reason to. What she recalls is that that is a term that this defendant used when speaking of people like her husband who were possessed by these evil spirits. We heard from Christina Atwood as well, the same concept that Lori Vallow repeatedly would say.
Did she tell you, as well as the other women who were at this meeting in February, that her husband was possessed?
Yes.
So it wasn't just you in a private conversation?
Correct.
She was open about it?
Yes.
So again, we see this ongoing timing of Lori Vallow talking of her evil, dark husband, who she later is authorized under her religion to get rid of. We know as well from Christina Atwood that there is a progression of these beliefs becoming more deviated from the LDS religion as she is meeting with her between February and June when she finally hears those words. From the time you started meeting with these gatherings in February through to June, did you start to see sort of a progression of things that Lori was telling you that seemed outside of your faith?
Yes.
Did
she make statements to you that you believed went against your religion?
Yes.
Did she at any point tell you that she did not need to repent anymore?
Yes.
What is that meaningful to you in your religion?
We believe that every single person outside of Jesus Christ has reason to repent.
Other than Lori Vallow, according to her words to multiple people. So let's take all of this, the motives and this timeline now, and talk about some of the jury instructions and all the evidence that supports proof beyond a reasonable doubt that this defendant is guilty. I want to start with talking to you about direct and circumstantial evidence. You have a jury instruction that tells you that evidence may be direct or circumstantial, that direct evidence is the testimony of what a witness saw, heard, or otherwise sensed, and circumstantial evidence is proof of a fact or facts from which you may find another fact. You're told the law makes no distinction between direct and circumstantial evidence. And this is relevant. The witnesses have often been questioned. Did you see, hear, or do that? What you are told is you can actually use circumstantial evidence to convict anyone. But let me give you an example of this. Imagine you are sitting on a beach. Just you, it's quiet. Off to your right, there's some rocks and you can't see around that. While you're sitting there, a person walks by, you watch them walk by and they go around the rocks and you can't see them anymore. And then someone runs up 5 minutes later and they say, hey, did you see someone come by here? You say, well, yeah, I saw them walk that way. That is direct evidence. You saw it. Now imagine you're on that same beach and it's completely empty. You close your eyes for 5 minutes. Just relax. Before you closed your eyes, the beach was completely pristine. And when you open them up, now you see footprints. You can see the toes facing off to your right, the heels, and you see them go all the way around the rocks there. Somebody again runs up 5 minutes later and they say, hey, did someone come by here? And you go, well, I mean, I didn't see him, but they must have gone by in the last 5 minutes because you can see their footprints. They went that way. That is circumstantial evidence. You can infer from that that someone went by and where they went. The burden of proof. The state has the burden of proof, as we absolutely should. So let's talk a little bit about what it is and what it is not. You're told that the burden of proof is proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And the instruction tells you that that leaves you firmly convinced in the defendant's guilt. You're told there are very few things in this world that we know with absolute certainty. And in criminal cases, the law does not require proof that overcomes every doubt. If, based on your consideration of the evidence, you are firmly convinced that the defendant is guilty of the crime charged, you must find him or her guilty. So I want to start by saying what proof beyond a reasonable doubt is not. It is not proof beyond all doubt. It is not proof beyond all conceivable doubt. It's not proof beyond all possible doubt, and it's not no doubt. You're told that there are very few things in life we know with absolute certainty. So just because someone says, what if, that is not a reasonable doubt. What you're told is it's proof beyond a reasonable doubt. As we go through the evidence and apply it to the crimes, we will show you that there is no reasonable doubt as to this defendant's guilt. So let's start with the crime itself, conspiracy to commit first-degree murder. There are three stages in this, or three things the state must prove. One, that the defendant or her co-conspirator caused the death of another person. Well, we know that Alex Cox shot and killed Charles on July 11th of 2019. Alex called 911. Alex indicated he was the shooter. He was the only one home. It was his gun. his credit card or debit card was in there with the gun. And we know that Lori told the police that her brother killed Charles. So we know that he caused the death of, so that. Two, that they intended or knew that she or a co-conspirator would cause the death of another person. When we are looking at this case, we are looking at the defendant's words, actions, and motive. The words and actions of having her brother, Alex, come over on the 10th with a gun so that he would be there when Charles came over to pick up JJ. The actions that day of taking Charles's phone, ensuring that he could not leave, that he could not take his son to school. The defendant told the detectives how angry and screaming Charles was about the phone, but she didn't just give it to him, throw it at him, tell him to get out, whatever you might do. She held on to it and told the police that she walked away with it as he's trying to grab it. The defendant's actions and words show us that she is the only reason why Charles stayed in there and the only reason why Charles was shot. Then there's those 12 minutes. Defendant tried to pretend that this was a quick, angry scuffle. But Charles is there for 12 minutes. The defendant is there for 12 minutes. Alex is there for 12 minutes before she leaves. We look at her actions when she came back. She told the police her brother was hit in the head with a bat. She never asks how he is. She's not concerned about his injury. She's not concerned about her husband being dead on the floor of her house, her child now without a father. The lack of words that she said there and her demeanor show again that she was well aware of what was going on and part of this incident. We look at her words to Chad, that Charles changed his life insurance policy before we got rid of him. They show her intent to kill Charles. And again, we look at the motive, money and Chad. When did this happen? The first time Charles came back into town after he found out about the affair. Finally, the state has to prove that the defendant or the co-conspirator acted with premeditation. So I'm going to talk to you about premeditation. You have a jury instruction for it, and it tells you that the defendant or the co-conspirator intended to kill another human being or knew she or the co-conspirator would kill another human being, and that after forming that intent or knowledge reflected on the decision before killing. It is this reflection, regardless of the length of time in which it occurs, that distinguishes first-degree murder from second-degree murder. You're also told an act is not done with premeditation if it is the instant effect of a sudden quarrel or heat of passion. This is where you remember those 12 minutes and the calmness of her walking around with that phone and her demeanor. You're told the time needed for reflection is not necessarily prolonged, and the space of time between the intent or knowledge to kill and the act of killing may be very short. So I'm going to give you an example. It's a lot of legalese, and then we'll talk about what we really have here. So imagine again, you are driving your car. You do every day, and you're coming up to an intersection and you see the light turn yellow. And in that second you think, do I want to run it? Or do I want to slam on my brakes and hit stop before I go into the intersection? You think about that and then you decide, I'm going to slam on my brakes and I'm going to stop. That is the time it takes to reflect. That is the time it takes for premeditation. But we have a lot more than this, because we have planning, not just premeditation that morning. So when we talk about the premeditation that we see, it starts at least back in June, when we have Christina telling us about Alex Cox saying that he wanted to kill Charles, Lori having no reaction to that, and instead talking about drugging Charles.
Did you hear Alex making some comments?
Yes.
And you told us that they made you uncomfortable. What were these comments?
He stated he wished that he could just kill Charles.
Okay. Was Lori around when he was saying this?
Yes, one of the times.
Okay. So he said it more than once?
Yes.
Can you describe for us part of his demeanor when he's saying this about wanting to just kill Charles?
It was jocular, just as I recall, he was standing up and just talking about it pretty loudly.
And you said one of the times that he said this, it was around Lori.
Yes.
Did she react in any way to hearing her brother say that he wished he could just kill her husband?
Not that I recall.
By July 9th, or when we start having this planning that we're talking about, we know that Lori Vallow is living in a house paid for by Charles Vallow. We know from even her statements to Detective Englund that she doesn't like Charles, is what she says, but Charles won't file for a divorce. We know from her words and text messages that she wants to be with Chad Daybell, but Charles is her cash cow. She hasn't worked. He pays rent, car, cell phones, her travel. And so, as far back as June 9th, we're already hearing that Alex and Lori would like to not just get rid of Charles, but kill him. But if you think that June 9th wasn't the beginning of this planning, this idea, this concept that Lori and her brother have of getting rid of Charles, this evil, dark, possessed person, that we know on the 9th that there is definitely a plan by this defendant. And we see that through those text messages with Melanie, with Summer, with Alex, where she speaks of the mission, where she talks about telling Melanie, you can't leave. You gotta pretend to be sick and stay here and keep track of Brandon so he doesn't come help Charles. You can't be in the picture. We need to stay here to defend ourselves from an intervention. The 10th, again, we have Melanie who is talking to her and saying, or this, that she wants to just go to this wedding. And what does Lori tell her? No, you have to stay here for the mission. The mission of stopping an intervention? No. As we continue through the 9th, we see Lori getting everyone lined up to help her. Alex, where he again is told that he will be like Nephi, just like her. Now Lori tells him it's an intervention. Everyone knows, Adam told you what's an intervention? It's talking to someone. It's common language. But that's not what the defendant wants to happen. She doesn't want Charles to divorce her and lose his money. She doesn't want this intervention to happen where she loses her temple recommend. What she wants is to be like Nephi and get rid of her husband.
Well, Nephi was a prophet in the Book of Mormon. It's the first chapter. He was a prophet, very humble and faithful servant of the Lord. Ironically enough, his brothers tried to kill him at one point. but he actually ended up going to Jerusalem to get these plates back, and he was run off, came back, and then went back again because the Lord asked him to. And when he did, the King Laban, who was actually a wicked king, was laying on the ground drunk in front of him. And Nephi was told to kill Laban.
Who was he told by?
The spirit, or, yeah, God.
So God was using a Holy Spirit to tell him to kill Laban? And
yes.
Did he?
Yes, he did.
Was that something he anguished over?
Yes.
But ultimately, it was a justified killing.
Yes.
You heard from Detective Duncan that everyone he spoke with gave this same story. And again, the defendant questioned others about this story. But what we've heard is, from Detective Duncan and from Adam, that Nephi is this justified killing. When we think about her religious beliefs and what she's been telling people about not needing to repent, about telling people who is dark and evil, a zombie or a Z, that she is above the priesthood, it makes sense that she feels justified in determining who should live or die, just as she told her brother on the ninth. And we know that, in fact, we're talking about a justified killing because Alex brought a gun over. He didn't bring the Book of Mormon to talk to Charles about something. He didn't bring a friend to try to record Charles saying something. He brought a gun with him. And then he waited there for his sister's husband to come into the house so he could kill him. What we see is a very planned out, premeditated murder. But let's talk about some additional premeditation. Again, as we're looking at Summer, we see on the 10th that Lori is having her sister update her on where Adam and Zach are staying, so she knows they're not with Charles. They're not coming over. They're not going to be interfering with their justified killing. And there's that 12-minute time where the defendant desperately wanted to rewrite the timeline as they told the police that day. This just happened. It was very quick, but it wasn't. It was 12 minutes. Charles arrives at 7:37 and Lori leaves at 7:49. During this time is when that plan, that premeditated murder, occurred. So let's talk about that as well. The evidence at the scene, the physical evidence, supports this premeditated murder. Alex fired two shots. One of them went through Charles' center mast, exited out his back, and went into the floorboard. The second one, Charles was on the floor, on his back, bleeding out, still able to move, and we know that because he had blood on his left hand, and he was executed as he lay there on the ground. In that time, when we talk about premeditation and reflection, as Adam had to move his hand down, reposition the gun, and discharge and pull the trigger one more time, that is premeditated first-degree murder, no matter what you believe before that. Again, when we talk about that physical evidence, we saw the fact that the location of that bullet defect in the ground matched right under Charles's left shoulder. And we heard from Dr. Bumgardner. Dr. Bumgardner told you that this was a classic Shored wound. And no matter how many questions could be asked about him of maybe a bamboo shirt might stop a bullet in one location but not in another, or how many matrix-like hypotheticals where maybe Charles bounced back up and then on his way down, the bullet slowed down through him and waited till he hit the ground again before it exited. Dr. Bumgardner told you, no, those hypotheticals, those issues did not make sense. He's never seen a t-shirt stop a bullet in one location or at all. And we know Charles didn't bounce because we know he had no injuries to the back of his head. This also tells us a little bit about the shooting itself. When Charles was shot that first time through center mast, he did not fall straight back and land onto the ground, laying there on his back. If he had, he would have had bruising, abrasions on the back of his head when he hit the ground. He didn't have anything on the back of his head. Where did he have abrasions? On his knees. When he fell to the ground after being shot, do we know how long it took him to roll over, to fall onto his back, before he was then shot a second time because he's still alive? You heard it could take up to 2 minutes for Charles to have died, and that he could have spoke and moved during that time period. What we do know is that he eventually ended up on his back. And while he was on his back is when he was shot the second time by Alex. This defendant and her brother in that house waiting and making sure that Charles was dead, murdered, executed. Words, actions, motive, and physical evidence all tell you what happened that morning. So let's talk about conspiracy. And I know there are a lot of layers here, and I'm just building them up for you. You're told in your jury instructions that conspiracy requires proof. One, the defendant agreed with one or more persons that one of them or another would engage in certain conduct. So again, we look to Lori Vallow's words. What she had been talking about for months, Charles being possessed, being dark, wanting to kill him, the discussion on June 9th, poisoning him or drugging him previously. And then when we got to July 9th, it is all coming to a head. We will be like Nephi. Her actions, having Charles come to the house, instead of him staying there, she had him stay away. Why? Because if Charles stayed at the house, couldn't have Alex come over with a gun and be ready to shoot him, right? You gotta have him come in. Her actions of inviting her brother over with a gun the night before so he would be there. She knew when he would show up, he texted her, "I'll be there at 7:30, pick up JJ." But most importantly, why did Charles stay in the house? Lori told the detective that Charles initially was like, "Oh, I'll just stay here for 20 minutes and then I'll take JJ to school." Well, she wasn't gonna kill him in front of JJ. "No, take JJ to Burger King. Get him out of the house, go put him in the car." And he does that. But then she takes his phone. And she won't give it back. What she told the detective was, before this alleged Tylee bat, whatever thing you want to talk about there, that she had Charles's phone and was asking him about texting Adam. Of course, that's interesting because how would she have known that? But we know she had the phone actually for a while before she did that interview. She tells the detective numerous times that Charles is telling her to give him back his phone, and she will not. That she's walking around as he's trying to get the phone. She won't give it to him. Why? Because she needs Alex to come out. He brought that gun over for a reason. So she agreed with one or more persons, her brother, Alex, that she intended to promote or assist the commission of such conduct. Well, of course, we know both the promote, she is the one who on the 9th said, we will be like Nephi. It's time to stop this whole thing. Charles trying to take my temple recommend, all this stuff that's going on, time to kill him. And of course, she assists by ensuring that Charles stays in the house when she takes that phone. And of course, they knew that it would constitute first-degree murder. It's what Nephi did. Only unlike Nephi, where it was justified, here, ladies and gentlemen, this murder was not justified. Finally, think about the demeanor when you're thinking about, again, words, actions, motive, and demeanor. When Lori comes back to the house, she is very, what did we hear that word many times? Nonchalant, calm, no questions about her brother, no questions about her husband, no questions about the house, just laughing about her neighbors. She is in absolute agreement with what has happened. She knows what's happened and she's calm and good with it because she doesn't need to repent. She is able to determine who should live and die, and she has done that. So when we talk of the scope of conspiracy, you're told that to prove a conspiracy, it is not necessary to show a formal meeting or express agreement. But we see that from the 9th, in that conversation that she and Alex had, where she tells him, you are going to have to stay near me for the next couple days, and we will be like Nephi. You're also told that a conspiracy may be inferred from circumstances showing a common criminal objective. So, because you don't have someone who says, I heard them say, we shall conspire, you can infer that from the conduct of what happened on the 9th, the conduct of what happened on the 10th, and the conduct of what happened on the 11th. All infer to you a conspiracy of Alex coming over with his gun to shoot and kill Charles. As we again look at this and this conspiracy, again, we're looking at the same words and actions. March, Charles is no longer there. There's just an evil spirit in his body. June, Charles is still possessed, and now Alex is saying he wants to kill him. Lori is fine with this, and she says she's drugging him or had been drugging him. And then 2 weeks before, all of a sudden, Charles knows Lori's been having this affair. Lori's words, actions, motive, and the physical evidence. Conspiracy again, we see that Lori and Alex know exactly when Charles is showing up. Alex doesn't go to the door, according to Lori, and confront Charles or tell him, we'll send JJ out and you can leave with him. The world is so difficult. How hard would that be? Bring JJ right to the door and let him leave with his dad. Now, you aren't going to shoot him outside. You want to make it look like self-defense inside. As you go through this, and we think about what's going on, the defendant doesn't even care. She wants her husband killed so bad that she's willing to let her brother bring over a loaded gun in an unlocked gun case in a house with a 7-year-old autistic child. That's fine. When the defendant was questioning Detective Enclan, she was talking about how hot it was outside. JJ's out in the car. But she has no problem with an unlocked gun in the house with the kid, and she's worried about her child out in the car. She's not. We know that because she's the reason Charles doesn't go back out into the car and leave. She keeps him there in the house. She is why JJ's out in the car alone. She has to keep him there until Alex comes out and can shoot and kill him. When we talk about that premeditation, obviously we're talking about that message. We know from the ninth on, they are premeditated, they are conspiring, and it's all heading to July 11th. We look at the timing of this, and this is actions and non-actions. Charles is in the house for 12 minutes. After those 12 minutes, they wait 47 more minutes before they call 911. Why? To stage the scene. No CPR is performed. They wait for Charles to be dead, and then they talk during this time period. They talk. They could call 911, but nope, they're going to just talk. So again, you're looking at their actions, what happened and didn't happen, and the motives. There's the gun that was used to kill Charles. We're going to go through a couple of these exhibits, some of what Lori said, and it's exhibits 192 and 197, where she again says that Charles came over and said he was just going to hang out at the house for like 20 minutes. Take JJ to school. She, of course, tells him to go. And when JJ is out in the car, she has Charles's phone. And she won't give it back. And no matter how much she says that Charles is screaming at her to give the phone back, she won't. And all of this conversation about Charles demanding the phone back is prior to her statement to Detective Enclan that Tylee comes out with this bat. This is all her doing. This is her as an accomplice assisting and promoting this murder. Lori is setting up Charles so Alex can shoot him.
And with JJ?
Mm-hmm. So he put them in the car,
okay,
in the driveway, and then he came back in. Right, so I kissed JJ goodbye. He came back in, and his phone was on the counter, and I had his phone. And he was like, give me my phone, and I was like, why don't you show me your text that you've been texting, blah, 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 you know, whatever. Because he's like acting really weird, like he's plotting something against me. Like, I'm like, why are you even here? Like, what did you come here for, you know? He's been talking to my other brother, and my brother came into town at the same time last mm-hmm. night, and I haven't talked to my brother in a while, my other brother, and I was like, and so he was texting him on the phone when he first got to my house, and I'm like, why are you texting Adam? Like, do you even talk to him? Like, my other brother.
So when you listen to these clips and the interview of Lori Vallow, you have to put into context, this is 9:52 in the morning when this part of this interview is occurring. And she's telling the detective that she confronts Charles about texting her brother Adam. Now, she's had the 47 minutes she's been driving around, and then that time at the house when she's waiting outside to learn all of those texts and what's been going on between her brother and Adam and Charles. And so she is now mixing this in to her interview. And so when you're listening to her interview, we know she's trying to work out this, what happened? How did this go? You can watch her demeanor as well. And as you're going through this, see how she's just telling a story here, like what happened, almost chuckling about it.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So this morning he comes back in and...
He comes back in, I went and gave him his phone. He was screaming at me to give him his phone. He was very worried about whatever was on his text mm-hmm. that he did not want me to see. And so I was just holding it there and he was screaming at me. And I was kind of walking towards around the house with it so he couldn't get it. He's like reaching for it and stuff like that.
So again, JJ's in the car. Tylee's not out. Alex isn't out. And she is making sure that he doesn't leave. She's walking around the house holding his phone, refusing it to give it to him, making sure her autistic child is sitting out in the car even longer so that she can ensure that exactly what they've been planning happens, that Alex has time to come out with the gun that he brought over and shoot and kill Charles. This defendant is the only reason why Charles didn't leave with JJ. This defendant is the one who provoked Charles by taking his phone and refusing to get it back. This defendant is the one who ensured that Charles was inside without JJ so Alex could shoot him. And this defendant is the person who set up Charles so that her brother, Alex, could shoot him. Let's talk about staging the scene. We know, obviously, from the first responders that when they arrived, no CPR was given. You heard from Officer Where's Becky that when he felt Charles's neck, he thought he was dead already, but they still let the first responders in because they've been told CPR had been given. And what do we know? That they arrived within a few minutes. No one had ever tried to save Charles. No blood had been pushed out of him from CPR, whether strong or light. He had been dead for quite a while. His skin was mottled when they started cutting open his shirt and looking to the back, and lividity, the blood pooling, was occurring already. So they kind of knew something was off with that timeline. So what about the scene itself? The bat. It is placed to the right of Charles to look like he was using it. Got shot and went flying behind him. Well, obviously we've heard from Kay, Charles's sister, that he was left-handed. We know from the blood evidence on his hand, he was left-handed. There's no damage to that mirror. There's no damage to the drywall. There's no damage anywhere. Like, this bat is being swung around in this horrific fight that's going on of grappling. The injury to Alex Cox's head. You heard it was a small 1-inch cut that he was using a paper towel to pat, and at times, as we watch that exhibit one, rubbing it, making sure it stays bleeding. There is no blood at the scene from this giant grappling thing going on that Lori Vallow wanted them to believe. His head is bleeding and they're grappling around and he's being beat with this bat, and yet not one drop of blood on the floor. Not one drop of blood going down the hallway when he put that gun away. Not one drop of blood on the gun itself. And then the shoes, left by the door to look like Lori Vallow had run out in fear after this horrific incident that they planned. But we know from the Walgreens video is that she did enter the store with shoes, something on her feet. So we're gonna go through. We know Charles, again, left-handed.
Field with your brother.
Yeah.
What position did your brother play?
He was a pitcher. He was very, very good. He was a left-handed pitcher, and they're very hard to hit against.
Okay. Did he bat right or left-handed?
He was left-handed.
Did he do everything left-handed?
Yes.
Left-handed? So we know that Charles batted left-handed, not right-handed. And what we know is Lori Vallow had a story about how Charles was using that bat. And it becomes very important as well when we're talking about the staging of the scene. This is Exhibit 193.
Yeah, she was outside.
And what happened?
Then they got up from that, and my brother had, like, stepped back, I guess, and then Charles was coming with me at the back, yelling at me to give him his phone, mm-hmm. still, because I had it in my hand. It was all really quickly, mm-hmm. and then when I went around, kind of in the circle, then my brother was there.
When you said when you were going around and he was coming at you with the bat, mm-hmm. how was he holding the bat?
Just like that, like backwards, almost in one arm.
Like he was swinging it backwards? He would have been like
he would have swung it backwards at me, not frontwards.
Okay.
So Lori Ballard tells Detective Enclan that Charles is swinging the bat backwards. Now, if the bat was like this when he was shot, the arm would have been shot. Covers his center mass. So we know he wasn't here. So if he's out here, where would the bat go? Down? Out? Somewhere that way to his left. It would not end up thrown up above him. And if it wasn't there again, Charles would have been shot through the arm. Obviously, Alex forgot that Charles was left-handed. So when he placed that, like he was coming at him with a bat, their stories didn't quite match up with the evidence. So if we rely on Lori's story of how Charles was holding the bat, then there's zero way that that bat would end up where it ended up. And again, we know he's left-handed from not only Kay, but his own admissions of that blood on his hand. So we see the scene is staged, this bat that is so necessary to try to ensure this justified killing is legally justified and not just spiritually justified. When we talk about the scene as well, and you're looking at where Charles was, at least when that second shot went through him. You can see in the photograph to the right, the shot to Charles's chest, right between his nipples, and the shot to Charles's abdomen, down lower. We know that that first shot through his chest, that Charles would have been facing a little more towards the open area there where we see the hallway and the kitchen. We know that because there was the bullet trajectory Detective Coons told you about that entered that far east wall. We know there was stippling, and so the defendant would have been, well, her brother would have been within 2 to 4 feet of the muzzle of that gun within Charles, 2 to 4 feet. We know from the lack of that injury to the back of his head that he didn't fall straight back. We know from the blood on his hand that he was still alive after he was shot. And we know the lack of stippling for that shot to his abdomen and that trajectory, and even the defendant's own statements that she saw her brother at Charles's feet, that he would have stood there at Charles's feet when he fired that second shot as he was laying on the floor. You have the bat, Exhibit 249. You look at the edge of it, you see the photograph of the edge of it. There is no blood and no damage to this bat. Regardless of how many times the defendant was hoping that blood was invisible, we have all cut ourselves and seen that blood is red. And there was no blood on this bat. There is no blood on this bat. There is no damage to this bat. So you have a semi-professional baseball player who has a bat in his hand and he sees someone with a gun and doesn't beat him with it, take his head off with it, knock him unconscious with it. Instead, all we see on this bat is zero damage and 2 partial prints. No prints of a body or smushed skin on it, someone that's sweating from a fight that's left a large arm print on it or anything else? Nope, just two partial little prints on it. When you think about what is there and what isn't there, does the evidence of this bat fit in at all?
No.
It doesn't. We look at Charles's watch. No damage to it. No scratches to it. No dings to it as he's grappling on the floor like Lori wants you to believe. We know that at some point, Charles is standing and shot, and we know that final shot, he's on the ground. We know he fell to his knees at some point. And when you look at that physical evidence and the lack of damage or anything on that bat, again, what makes sense is that Charles fell to his knees after that first shot. We know that there is 12 minutes where the defendant and her brother are still together there so that Alex can get this 1-inch cut to the back of his head that's barely bleeding, that he uses a paper towel to dab at and rub. The shoes that the defendant ran out of on her way out. You have the exhibit. You can see black straps across her toes as she enters and exits the Walgreens. And then you see that she's wearing the flip-flops when she comes back to the scene. What do we know? That the police did not search Charles's rental car. Credibility. You are given a credibility instruction and you use it for everyone, including the defendant. You're told that you really evaluate people the same way. You're looking for any inconsistencies in their stories, any reasons why they may have a motive or bias to lie, any prejudice they may have, and then you look at everything in light of reason, common sense, and experience. When you think of the testimony of the people who've come here and talked to you, Christina Atwood, Serena Sharp, Nancy Jo Hancock, Adam Cox, Dr. Bumgarner, the detectives, Robin Smith Scott, Mark Zari, what benefit do these people have in being untruthful to you? They have body cameras, they have prior documents, and they have memories of what this defendant said. But the credibility of Lori Vallow is something you do need to consider. And you start with her demeanor that day where she wasn't worried about anything when she arrived. Her brother has allegedly been hit in the head with a bat by her husband who plays semi-pro ball. She doesn't even worry about him. She knows he's not hurt. He's fine. And why does she know that? Because that was staged. When she's there and we see her on body cam arriving, she's just nonchalant and calm. And I know the defendant wanted to make sure that it was clear that everyone else was calm, but no one else had just allegedly seen their husband get shot and killed by their brother. When you were looking at the reasonableness of her testimony, you have to consider it in the light of reason, common sense, and experience. And the way that she was acting and reacting that day, as well as her own statements, do not fit the evidence, do not fit the physical evidence, and you will see her credibility throughout this whole case has been questionable. Her credibility with Social Security. What did we learn? That on July 11th, she tells Detective Endplan that she and Charles are separated. It's Exhibit 187. We are not living together. Charles rented her house. We're separated. But on August 12th, when she needs to make sure she gets some money, she tells Social Security, when they ask, are you living together at the time of death? Yes. You also learned that she was not truthful with Social Security when she got remarried. She did not tell them about that either. So we know she's been untruthful to Social Security twice. Why is that relevant? Because you're judging the credibility of Lori Vallow throughout all of this. Life insurance. We know that she said Charles was accidentally shot. We know that was not true. She wanted to make things seem like she had nothing to do with the murder. But we know that Alex Cox intentionally shot Charles. Whether or not she wants to claim it's self-defense or not, there was nothing accidental about shooting him twice. Then that second call to Banner Life Insurance, where she tells Robin Smith Scott a few different things to garner sympathy, and she asked her if she could do anything about the change in beneficiary.
I can't give too much information, but I can tell you that the beneficiary was changed in March of this year.
Okay. Okay, I'm trying to figure out what he was doing since we have 5 kids and we've been married for 15 years.
I'm sorry.
So Lori tells this woman, we have 5 kids, which if you want to count them all and admit that 3 of them are adults, then okay. Really, they have 1 kid in common. Tylee, you learned, was actually getting Social Security survivor benefits from her dad's death starting in 2018. Lori's son, Colby, isn't living with them. Charles' son's never lived with them. Why does she say these things? She can't help it. She's just wants to just make herself seem better than she is. What about the credibility of her interview? Even during the police interview, we talked about a few things, but one of the things she told the detective.
And I didn't file anything or whatever. And then he filed something against me and said, I'm only going to get supervised visits because I'm crazy and blah, 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 you know, the story. And so I just didn't talk to him for like 30 days and let him take care of him and let him see what I've been doing.
So again, she can't even be honest and say 2 months. She's got to be like 30 days. I was kind enough to just leave my husband with my son for 30 days. What we know is that Lori Vallow was gone a total of 78 days, 58 while she's flying to Hawaii, going to Idaho and back with Chad. And who's taking care of JJ? Charles. And Kay is coming here regularly to help take care of JJ, to help run the business. And then eventually on March 28th, that's when Charles finally decides he hasn't been able to find Lori. He doesn't know where she is. He's going to move to Houston to be closer so his sister can help him more easily. And this is when Lori finally shows back up. So again, even the simplest thing of just trying to be honest about how long she's been gone, she has to minimize it and make herself seem better.
With your cross.
The shoes. Oops. If this will play. When she was questioning Detective Enclam, she was asking her if it was hot in July and if she would need shoes to go take her son to school. But of course, what we know is that we saw her with those shoes on as she went into Walgreens. So again, it's continued trying to garner sympathy and just being untruthful about whatever she feels like being untruthful about. And then we look at the credibility in that timeline, that body cam.
Well, this, you know, now that you're not in Santana, this is your home.
Right, gotcha. Right.
Okay.
We just lived there.
Gotcha. How long have you guys lived here?
Sorry?
How long have you lived here?
Like 3 weeks.
Oh, geez. Yeah, okay.
That's why the neighbors don't know us.
Gotcha.
Like, hi, neighbor, sorry.
Are you working?
So here she is, 47 minutes after leaving the house, laughing and smiling with the detective about the fact that her husband is dead inside the house. Her brother is sitting on the curb, allegedly with this very serious injury from a baseball bat. When you look at that credibility of the defendant, you have to look at everything together and what fits, again, with the physical evidence and what doesn't. Finally, Let's talk about the justification defenses. What we know is that Lori Vallow thought she was like Nephi, that she was justified in killing Charles, that her brother, who was supposed to be like her, was also justified in killing Charles. But Lori Vallow is not justified under Arizona law, nor is Alex. So let's go through the different justification defenses. First thing that you have to consider for every one of these, self-defense, defense of a third person, or crime prevention, is the non-justification for use of deadly physical force. You are told, if a person is not just, or a person is not justified in using or threatening physical force or deadly physical force against another in response to verbal provocation alone. So Charles yelling and screaming at her to give his phone back does not justify you shooting him. Or a person is not justified in using or threatening deadly physical force if the defendant or co-conspirator provoked the other's use or attempted use of unlawful physical force. So we know here Lori provoked Charles by taking his phone and refusing to give it back. So again, when we look at every one of these defenses, you'll see not only do they not apply, but none of them is the defendant entitled to. This is not self-defense. In self-defense, you're told that a person, a reasonable person, can use deadly physical force if they believed that deadly physical force was immediately necessary to protect against another's use or apparent attempted or threatened use of unlawful deadly physical force, and the person used or threatened no more deadly physical force than would have appeared necessary to a reasonable person in this situation. We know that Lori Vallow used Charles's phone to get him to come back inside, and she used his phone to keep him inside and give her brother time to come out and shoot and kill Charles. We know from the physical scene itself that Charles did not use a bat. We know from the physical evidence of Alex's 1-inch cut to his head and the lack of blood or concussion, the lack of damage to the mirrors, the walls, the location of the bat in relation to Charles, they all tell us that Charles did not use a bat. We know that Charles was a semi-professional baseball player. This would not have ended that way if he had had a bat. But even if you somehow think that he did have a bat and he was swinging it at Alex, the defendant, whoever, he still was not justified in shooting him when he was on the ground. It has to be immediately necessary to protect against another's use. When Charles is on the ground and he is shot that second time, there is no threat to anyone. And so that is not self-defense.
Counsel, I need to give my court reporter a break unless you think you'll be done in the next 5 minutes. Okay, go ahead.
When we look at the physical evidence, again, we know that Charles was on the ground, shot, and so this is not self-defense. And we know from the physical evidence at the scene, the projectile into the floorboard, this is not self-defense. Third party. You're told that a person is justified in using or threatening deadly physical force in defense of a third person, I presume here Lori Vallow, if a reasonable person in the situation would have believed that deadly physical force was necessary to protect against another's use, again, of unlawful deadly physical force against a third person, and they used only what was necessary for a reasonable person under the situation. What do we know? Lori Vallow told Detective Englund that she wasn't even in the room when she heard the shot, that she had gone around into the kitchen. Who's he protecting at that point? What third person that's no longer there is he protecting? You can't protect against a future, what might happen, or what already occurred. It has to be now. And Lori Vallow herself put herself outside the room when her brother shot Charles. So there is no third-party defense. But again, the same thing applies. Even if you thought so, that second shot removes any possibility of being justified. Crime prevention. This is the exact same thing, only in a slightly different stated way. But like self-defense, it allows a person to use deadly physical force against another to the extent a reasonable person would have believed that deadly physical force was immediately necessary to prevent Charles from committing aggravated assault against Lori Vallow. We know she's not in the room. Even if he had that bat and had been coming at her and then she left the room, that crime is over. And again, even if you believe he had the bat, you cannot shoot him while he's on the ground. That is not what crime prevention permits you to execute a person. Finally, there's mere presence. You're told that guilt cannot be established by a defendant's mere presence at the crime scene, mere association with another person at the crime scene, or mere knowledge that a crime is being committed. Lori Vallow wasn't just present at this crime scene. She brought her brother to the crime scene. She ensured that he brought a gun with him. She ensured that JJ was outside, and she ensured that Charles stayed inside. She was not merely present. She was a person who was actively participating in this crime. Ladies and gentlemen, we have talked about the evidence in this case. Evidence that was presented to you through witnesses who took the stand, and exhibits that were admitted for you to review. Remember the evidence of Lori Vallow's motive. Charles's life insurance, Chad Daybell. Remember Lori Vallow's own words of wanting to get rid of Charles, of drugging him, her acceptance of her brother's statements that he wanted to kill Charles, how she used Melanie and Summer to plan her mission and ensure that Charles didn't have help from Brandon or Zach or Adam. Her words to Alex about it all coming to a head, that he had to stay near her and they would be like Nephi, justified in killing Charles. And finally, her words to Chad Daybell on July 18th, confessing to the killing when she said Charles had changed the life insurance before we got rid of him. Look at her actions and demeanor, having her brother come over on the 10th to her house with a loaded .45 caliber handgun, creating the one and only reason why Charles stayed inside the house, why he didn't just take JJ to school. The 12 minutes that Charles is at the house before Lori leaves in the car, the 47 minutes after that before they call 911, her demeanor when she comes back, not caring that anyone has been hurt, her demeanor on the body-worn camera, during her interview, what you heard about during the drive. Think about her credibility, how she cried for you in her opening statement. You certainly didn't see her cry on that body camera footage. You didn't hear about her crying as she was being driven to the Family Advocacy Center, and you did not see her cry in her interview. Finally, think about the physical evidence that proves that Lori and Alex staged this scene, that Charles was never in possession of that bat when he was shot by Alex or either of the shots. That instead he was executed that day for this defendant's benefit. The physical evidence disproves beyond a reasonable doubt that Lori Vallow and Alex Cox were justified under the law in killing Charles. The jury instructions tell you to use reason, common sense, and experience. Charles Vallow is dead today because this defendant and her brother Alex Cox conspired to kill him. They planned it out, and they had their weapons, and they orchestrated a way to ensure that Charles was back in the house where he was shot and killed for money and Chad Daybell. The evidence proves to you that Lori Vallow, Daybell, is guilty of conspiracy to commit first-degree murder, and the state asks you to hold her accountable and find her guilty. Thank you.
All right, we're going to take our 15-minute afternoon recess. I'll remind the jurors to remember the admonition. We'll resume in 15 minutes.
All right, for the jury.
There's more live courtroom coverage coming up. Press subscribe now so you don't miss a second from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.